Welcome to God's Feast of Tabernacles. Aloha, everyone. This is a different look for me. I feel undressed. But it was 47 when we left home the other day, so you have to adjust, right? It's wonderful being here. My wife and I were here back in 1985. And I suspect, like so many places, no matter where you live, a lot has changed in 29 years. And it certainly has here. I've forgotten just the uniqueness of many of the trees, just the variety of vegetation, and just how verdant everything is. Can't say I'm thrilled with those roosters crowing at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, but anyway. One of the first jobs I had after graduating high school was working for a construction company that built pole barns. These were wooden-framed buildings sided with sheet metal. And they could be used for a variety of applications, whether it was garages or storage sheds or barns for animals or anything along that line. I didn't stay with that job for a number of reasons. I didn't stay there very long. First of which was I didn't like driving all over God's country to get to work. Sometimes my commute was an hour and a half or more, depending on where the job site was. The next aspect that I didn't like was working in the weather. I'm not an outside kind of guy working in the weather, rather. But, you know, the weather didn't matter. Somebody had hired us to build a barn. We had to build it, whether it was hot, whether it was cold, whether it was rainy, whether it was windy. It didn't really matter. But the thing that I really didn't like about the job was climbing around the top of the building as it was being made when we put up the roof portion. I didn't like working up high with little support. Now, we weren't that high up, probably 25, 30 feet maybe at the most, but I don't like that. You can put me in a tight spot, you can put me in a dirty spot, you can put me in the heat, but I don't like being exposed up high. I have a mild case of what's technically known as acrophobia, fear of heights. We live in a fearful world, in many cases with reason. It's a very scary place out there, and as I mentioned, the last 29 years, a lot has changed, even in the world scene. We hear of dangerous things happening all around us, and usually that fear comes because we cannot control or positively affect any difference in those events. So many times, that's why we fear. But I found some of these fears interesting. Let me just give you the top 10 list of fears. You can think about these before I tell you what they are, see if you know what they are. Arachnophobia, that's a famous one. Fear of spiders. Ophidiophobia, fear of snakes. Acrophobia, I mentioned, fear of heights. Agoraphobia, fear of situations where escape is difficult, confined in an area, not necessarily a tight space. Cynophobia, fear of dogs. Astrophobia, fear of thunder and lightning. I don't have that fear. In fact, one of the most awesome things about living in Wisconsin, and I cannot accurately say for myself that it's winter. I don't like winter. But one of the interesting things that can happen in winter in Wisconsin is that you get snow thunder. Have you ever seen snow thunder? It's really amazing. The sky lights up in a purple sort of color. But to have snow, rather thunder happen when it's snowing is really incredible. But some people have astrophobia. Trypanophobia, many of you probably have this. Fear of injections, don't like needles. There are many social phobias, that's under the general category of number 8. Social situations, whether it's speaking in front of a crowd or whether it's doing anything else in that sort of social setting. Pteromehanophobia, I hope none of you have this because that's fear of flying. Probably wouldn't have gotten here if you had that. And number 10 is misophobia, fear of germs or dirt. Maybe some of those fears affect you. Maybe they affect someone in your family, someone that you know. But God's called out one, interestingly enough, are not called to be driven by fear. The calling God gives us is not a calling of fear. I had an instructor in Ambassador College years ago in speech class that would quote to us the verse 1 John 4:18. You can be turning there. We hated him quoting this because he quoted it almost every class Because there were many that had this fear of social situations, fear of speaking in public. You know, you expose yourself. You stand up here in front of a large group. You know, your thoughts have to be cogent. They have to be organized. They have to be relevant. And he would quote this to us regularly. And it wasn't until years later that I began to have more of an appreciation of what he was trying to say there. But in 1 John 4:8, we read this, where John writes, "He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." That's verse 8. Verse 18, "There is no fear in love." See, they're incompatible. They're opposite ends of the spectrum. "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear." What does all this talk of fear, however, have to do with why we're here? Why we're gathered, along with many other thousands of God's faithful, this time of year, keeping his Feast of Tabernacles? Well, we gather before him to represent in advance something that God's going to do. We represent the time of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, a time of restoration, a time of Satan being removed so he's no longer able to directly influence mankind's decisions, a time of preparing the earth for the great resurrection, the event of the last great day. It will not be a time of fear. It will not be a time of greed and all of the social ills that we have now. And during this week, we have concentrated time. We'll be here for the next 8 days to learn more about God's way of life and how to practice living that way of life. And in those coming days, including today, we have the opportunity to hear about 19 sermonettes and sermon messages. In the next week plus, we'll hear about the same number of messages that we would normally hear in about a quarter of the year. That's a great deal of concentrated instruction. So let me come back to my question I asked. What does fear have to do with why we are here before God observing his Feast of Tabernacles? Well, in coming before God at any time, part of what we're to learn to do is to fear him. What I mean by that is fearing God, that is listening, obeying, proving, all of the things that we're asked to do. Also means that we learn the consequences of not following God's law so that we fear the outcome. Part of my fear of heights was knowing that if I fell, I'd hurt myself severely, depending on how I fell, where I landed. I didn't want that. I feared that outcome. There were others on the work crew that didn't. They would shimmy across those rafters whether they had frost on them or not. It didn't matter. But this week, we'll hear many messages about Christ's millennial reign. We'll hear more of that as the week progresses, how this world will be healed under his leadership. But none of that will happen if mankind doesn't learn that their way does not work. Right now, this world, this culture around us, does not fear the consequences of disobeying God. We see it replete around us in our businesses, in our governments, in our entertainment, in everything. People think that they can do whatever with no consequence. By the end of the tribulation, however, they will understand there are consequences. And then, perhaps, for the first time in a long time, they'll be receptive to be taught God's instruction. This time here at God's Feast of Tabernacles for us is practice time, because that time's not here yet. This is the time that we can begin to prepare so that we can be the example to the world then and now, so that we can be part of the functioning, if you will, of God's kingdom, his government, in leading those people out of a way of fear. So today, in this rest of the sermon time I have left, we're going to take a look at the proper fear we are to have in our relationship with God and how that is shown in observing these days of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, what I'm talking about here this morning involves reconciling two seemingly incompatible concepts about God. That is, to fear him and to love him. How do we reconcile that? Many critics of Christianity will point to this and say that this shows the impossibility of believing in a benevolent God. You're never going to please a God that expects you to fear him. So how do we do that? Well, before we get more into that. Let's consider this thought of love again. We read verse 8 here in 1 John 4. He who does not love God does not know God. And as we're told at the very end of that verse, for God is love. In order to know God, we have to know what his love is. Now, in 1 John 4, 8 here, the word love, many of you are familiar with, is the word agape. One of the very interesting things about this word is that it's unique in the Greek language. That what I mean by that is that oftentimes when translators would go to the Greek for the New Testament, when they came to a word to translate, they would look at the literature of the day. They would look how it was used in the daily application so that they used the word properly in translating it. But the interesting thing about this word agape was that it was not used very much at all in the Greek culture. So John here is the one that primarily defines it. It's a very unique word in the New Testament because it's more replete in the Greek New Testament writings than anywhere else. And so what we have here is the New Testament defining what this word means, what John means by it. The word agape in the scriptural context shows that John uses this word to express an outgoing or a sacrificial or a beneficial love towards others. It's thinking of others first. Some of you will remember decades ago we were taught that love can be selfish, right? We have a mother's love. That love can be selfish towards her child. It's a love, but still it's limited, isn't it? God's love expresses beyond that selfish aspect and goes beyond just what we understand in the world around us. It involves what he does for us. I mean, as was mentioned in the offertory message, think about what God gives us. It's not one thing we have, one thing we enjoy, one thing we will have in this life or the life to come that doesn't come from God. Do you know anybody else that gives you that much? Think of this from God's perspective. God loved us before he created us. In fact, it was the love between the ones that we know now as the Father and the Son that even caused all of this to be created. The reason for it, that they had such love between themselves that they wanted to have a family. You and I can understand that. As we mature, as we grow out of childhood, and we look towards marriage, and then as we get married, we look towards family, don't we? We want that same thing that God wanted. He made the universe for us and an earth to support life. And as much time as money has been spent searching for similar planets, so far they don't exist. And I would be very doubtful that any do. Life on this earth is fine-tuned to exist. God created all of that. He knew that his son would die for the sins of mankind before he ever created mankind. Think of that. That in creating mankind, he knew we would have the possibility. Because he was going to give us free will, we would have the possibility to choose wrong. To use the movie phrase, to choose poorly. And we do, don't we? All the time, unfortunately. But he had a remedy for that. He couldn't just paper over it. He had to send someone that was more valuable than all of that life to pay for that sin. And he created mankind to one day be in that family. That's agape love. Let's go next to 1 Peter 2, not too far from where we are. Let's add to this love a proper fear that we are to have. 1 Peter 2, and in verse 17, Peter writes this. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Fear God. Some will say the word fear mentioned oftentimes in scripture means to respect, and there are verses that mean that. But the Greek word oftentimes is the word phobio. That's why I started my message that way. Phobia is the English word we have from the Greek, from the Latin. Our English word means fear, and it means to be afraid of or to be frightened of something. So again, how do we reconcile these seemingly opposite references? We read the verses about loving God. We read here, and we'll read others where it talks about fearing God. Let's look at some of those other verses. Ephesians chapter 5. My point is not to explore the verses that talk about loving God. You can do that on your own later. There are many verses. You could spend a great deal of Bible study simply looking at the verses that expresses God's love and the love that we're to have, one to another and towards Him. But Ephesians 5:21, let's read this one next. Here Paul writes to the church at Ephesus, submitting to one another in the fear of God. That's worth pondering. Submission through fear. Not submission and fear to each other. Notice, as it says there, in the fear of God. All right, let's go back a little further. 2 Corinthians 7. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, and we'll read verse 1 here. Paul again writes, therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. There has to be something to this concept of fearing God that we need to understand. Else, why would we have these types of verses? Why would God be so clear about having this fear? So, in my mind, this is the way I think, the question is begged, does God want us to fear Him, to be afraid of Him? And the answer is yes and no. Humanly speaking, we can't truly love someone we fear, can we? Unfortunately, there are relationships that have those dynamics. They're not healthy relationships. Those emotions are too far apart. Those attitudes are too far apart. There is a deeper application, though, that we're talking about here of fearing God. And it has more to do with why we're here this week. It has to do with remembering the consequences of straying outside His law. Let's go to Matthew 10. This section makes this concept, this thought, a little more clear here. You and I function in this way whether we understand it or not. Do we fear the law of the land? Okay, when I moved to the state of Wisconsin, we lived in Rhode Island. And on the East Coast, speed limit signs are kind of a suggestion because everybody's moving together. Most police will not pull you over if you're even 10, 15 miles over the speed limit. In fact, one time I was coming back from visiting a member, driving on the one major highway in Rhode Island, because it's not a big state, and minding my own business, not really paying attention, and I was passed by a statey, Rhode Island state policeman. I looked down just out of force of habit. I was doing about 75. I don't know what he was doing to pass me at the speed he was doing. He didn't care. That's not something they look at. Well, habits are hard things to break, aren't they? So I moved to Wisconsin. They're not so forgiving, and especially with what they call secondary highways, the two-lane roads, I drove at speeds I was comfortable with. The police saw it differently. So in a very short time, in a matter of 3 years, I had 3 tickets. So I began to fear the speed limit. Well, you build other habits now, don't you? So I come here to Hawaii, and one of my irritations is there are no speed limit signs. So I don't know whether I'm obeying the law or not. There is a fear there, isn't there, though? A fear to follow the instruction. In Matthew 10, let's read in verse 28 here. Christ speaking says, do not fear those who kill the body. Now, but we do, don't we? We struggle to keep this life. We try to keep ourselves, as I mentioned in my fear of heights, away from things that will put us in danger. But Christ is reminding us, look, that's not the perspective I want you to have. He's built that into us so we don't kill ourselves quickly. But notice what he says here. Don't fear those who kill the body and cannot kill the soul. See, someone can take our life, but that's it, right? They can't take who we are. They can't take what God has developed in us. But rather, fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in the grave. Now we're talking about something, aren't we? See, we're to fear God because God can end this. What you and I are doing right now in these holy days, in the Sabbath day, in the calling that he's given us, whether we're baptized or not, he has given us an opportunity, a trial run, to find out what works. He's trying to guide us in that way. And it's not that he doesn't have a vested interest. He tells us what will work. He encourages us to live the right way. But if we don't, then he can end this all. So we're just a bunch of chemicals and electricity, aren't we? When you get right down to it, this life is nothing but chemistry and electricity. So what happens if he just turns off the electricity? We're nothing. This is worth remembering. Because God is the one who will judge each person. He tells us to pay attention to the fruit to see if they're following his law or not. That's a whole other discussion. But he's the one that will judge us for salvation. He knows what we've dealt with. He knows where we've come from. He knows what we've accomplished. He knows what we're thinking. And he sees us when no one else does. And he is the only one that can provide life forever. And he's the only one that can remove that possibility for life forever as well. What we are to fear in our relationship with God is the consequence of disobedience. Do we fear God in disobeying him? Do we fear the consequence of rejecting God's instruction? I do. And I suspect all of you do as well, otherwise you wouldn't be here. This fear for me is like the fear of heights I have, of standing up on high on an edge. I don't have a fear of heights being in something high. I'm fascinated in flying in airplanes and looking down and watching the land as it goes by, the cloud formations. I was reminded of that yesterday, looking out the plane and how beautiful all that is. That doesn't bother me in the least, but being on the edge up high, that's where everything gets wiggy in my stomach. But that fear should motivate us, shouldn't it? The reason we have fear, as I mentioned a little bit ago, was so that we do not put ourselves in danger. Sometimes that's rational, sometimes it's not. But that fear should motivate us to do the right thing. For me, it's stepping back from the edge. I've seen too many, unfortunately. I know there are others of you that have as well, who were once part of the Church of God who have walked away from his instruction. And their lives are the worse for it. Maybe not right away, maybe not completely. But they've distanced themselves from God. They no longer have a fear of disobeying him. The fear of God we are to have, however, should not be a fear that incapacitates us, as I've mentioned. A deep fear, a phobia, is oftentimes not a rational fear. It doesn't come from sound and logical thinking. For instance, I'll give you an example. Do you know what periscavi decatriophobia is? I probably didn't say that right, because I don't do those many syllables very well. The symptoms can include breathlessness, excessive sweating, nausea, dry mouth, feeling sick, shaking, heart palpitations, inability to think clearly, a fear of dying, becoming mad or losing control, sensation of a detachment from reality, or a full-blown anxiety attack. Do you know what that is? It's a fear of Friday the 13th. That's an irrational fear, isn't it? Let's look at 2 Timothy chapter 1 next. We are not to have an irrational fear of God. God is not an irrational being. God is very logical. He's very clear. He's also very merciful. God is not a God to fear in that we don't know what he's going to do next. Maybe some of you have grown up in households like that, unfortunately. You don't know what your parents are going to do next. You live in fear of what will set off an angry outburst or something of that regard. This is not the God we worship. If God wanted to punish mankind for his sins, there isn't one of us that would be sitting here right now. So 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. Paul writes to Timothy, "For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind, not an irrational fear, not to immobilize us, not so that we're without hope." This is not the fear we're talking about. But God does want us to be afraid of the consequences of rejecting his way of life, his instruction. So if we're striving to live in that instruction, we don't need to fear God any more than I need to fear the police when I drive down the highway. But some measure of fear is good if it keeps us safe, isn't it? God's love strengthens us, gives us peace in knowing how much he wants us to be in his family. You know, one of the interesting things they're coming to the conclusion on is that many social problems that we struggle with, whether it's a developmental issue with children, whether it's substance abuses, whether it's drugs or alcohol, whether it's all kinds of things, that one of the major things that can change that or cut that off in a young individual, young person in his life, is the involvement of his or her parents, a positive influence in their life. So we don't need to fear these things, because how much is God involved in your life? How much does he want you to accomplish? What is he encouraging you to be a part of? 2 weeks ago, we observed the Feast of Trumpets. That holy day pictures the coming of Jesus Christ, the second coming. His return to establish God's kingdom on this earth, a foretaste, not the final version, but the beginning of it. What has always astounded me in the events surrounding that day that we know from prophecy is that when he returns, mankind is going to be fighting him. Why? We talk of utopia all the time. We keep trying to convince ourselves as a race, human race, that we can fix all of this. We can solve our problems if we just have the right whatever, government, or the right amount of money, or the right intents, or the right people out of the picture, or the right people in the picture, or whatever it is. But I think a lot of the reason why mankind will be fighting God is because of Satan's lies. Perhaps through the beast and the false prophet, Satan will have convinced mankind that this one who comes from space is not a savior, but a destroyer. I mean, read some of those prophecies, if you didn't, around trumpets. Go back and read some of them. Satan will be front and center in those end time events, working with the governments, working with the religion. But I also think that a big part of what mankind will be doing in fighting against Christ will be done through fear. Fear of the unknown. I can't speak for other elders here, but oftentimes when I interact with somebody new that God might be calling, I can't assume they even know the Bible that you have on your lap. That they know where those books are, that they know the references we make. One of the things I tell my men locally all the time is we can't use church speak. Do you know what church speak is? When I say kingdom of God, you have an image in your mind, don't you? Okay, but there are other denominations that use that phrase. They don't mean the same thing we do. So we have to explain our descriptors, our language. And Satan is going to have mankind very fearful. Look at the fear in the world around us of everything. But also a fear because the standard of living that God has in store for mankind is not being done either. There are a lot of people that know, in spite of wanting to believe that God doesn't exist, that they're not living the right life. A big part of Christ returning on the Feast of Trumpets is to show his power, and that mankind should fear disobeying God. Let's go to Malachi chapter 3 next. Mr. Clark mentioned in his sermonette Deuteronomy 14:23. That instruction, if you remember, as he read there and we read with him, was that we are to learn to fear God. Part of what we do in rehearsing these holy days is to learn. Now, speaking personally, I've been doing this since 1968. I know many have probably even been doing it longer. Some of you, maybe this is your first year. But one of the things I also tell the members in my area is that I never get tired of this. I don't say that just because I get paid to. The reason I get paid to is because I like this. I spent 26 years before I was hired into the full-time ministry in the publishing advertising field. As an aside, there was only one boss that I feared in the right way, that I respected. There was only one that I feared letting down. Do we fear letting God down? God is not a God of because I said so. We don't like that as children, do we? But why? Because I said so. There's not enough information in there, is there? He tells us to put him to the test. That's a very secure God, isn't it? He's not worried about our questions. He's not worried about our doubts. He's not worried about our insecurities, our shortcomings, or just the fact that we can't wrap our head around what he's talking about. He's not concerned at all about that. And Malachi 3:10 proves this to it. Now, he's talking about tithing here. That's not the point of the sermon today. But the principle is still applicable. Because he says, bring the tithes into my storehouse. But while it's not the point of the sermon, let's ask the question, why? Because they were to learn, weren't they? Where everything came from. Notice, he says, if you do this, there will be food in my house, and try me now. I like the old King James better in this verse, because it says, prove me. See, God doesn't say, if you don't accept me without following through. Again, we read Acts in the sermonette, didn't we? To go back and prove what God is talking about. Is he correct? Prove me now. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing, there will not be room enough to receive it. Now, I've done this in my life with tithing, and I tell members this all the time, people that are struggling financially. Are you tithing? And almost always the answer is no. And their response is, I can't afford to. And my response is, you can't afford not to. God can't bless us if we're not putting forth the effort. Mr. Tuck talked about that, right? Where's our effort? God here is saying, I'm not so uncomfortable that you can't prove me. But I suspect this is why so many people don't want to follow God's way of life, because what happens if you prove God to be right? Now you have to live it, don't you? Because once I know the speed limit, if I go over it, now I knowingly violate it. And I don't have the excuse, well, I'm new, I don't know the area, I didn't know what the speed limit was. What I'm talking about is that we must have a relationship of trust with God. That fear involves trust. Because we would be paralyzed with fear and uncertainty in this life, even in the physical things, if we didn't trust, right? We all flew over here in a big aluminum tube with wings on it. You can't do that without trust. Because the more you think about it, the less sense it makes. Phobias are primarily lack of trust expanded. The same is true for us spiritually. We must trust God, as any child needs to trust the parent. And we teach them that. Don't run into the street. Why? Well, you're going to get hurt. You know, learn to stop. When I say stop, I don't have time to explain everything right away. In terms of what we talk about from Scripture, this trust is called faith. But that concept can seem very abstract at times, can't it? When a child is desperately sick and we have no more answers and the doctors are at a loss as well, that's hard, isn't it? When you've been unemployed for years on end, waiting on God, doing everything you can but still waiting on God, that's hard, isn't it? But this faith does involve trust. Trust that God will do as he promised, and that's why we obey him. Trust that he can control events. And I've seen it enough in my life. that when I come to these difficult times, I have to remind myself of those things. That God can control these trials and circumstances that we cannot. Hopefully you've seen that in your life as well. And maybe I've told people, maybe these things won't make sense for years. But even in matters of considering sin, we trust that God will forgive us, don't we? And that's a hard one to help people with when they don't trust that God will forgive their sin. But he also promises that he will strengthen us in ceasing from sin, that he is faithful in his promises and many other things. Let me just give you a few examples. You can write these verses down. We're not going to turn to them for the sake of time today, but they're worth pondering later. We know that God will provide for us. Matthew 6, verses 26 to 30. God provides for his creation. Christ talked about that, right? The sparrows, the grass of the field. Who runs that? God does. He may not provide what we want, but he will provide what we need. He also promises to protect us. Psalm 121, verse 3. That's a very real blessing. And I hope that all of you ask God for his protection on you and those that are traveling to his holy days, this feast, before you left home. I do it on a regular basis. Because if I drive like I do, what are those other people doing? And one of the more curious things, I talk about this back home, that I cannot get my head around is the three-lane exit. I see this no matter where I go. Where someone's driving down the highway, they're in the high-speed lane, and it's like suddenly they wake up, oh, this is my exit, and across the highway they go. God also promises to give us his peace and his blessing. Deuteronomy 30, verse 16. And the interesting thing about that one is that that instruction, that promise, is directly tied to obedience. Once we have trust in our relationship with God, then we can face fearful situations with confidence. 1 Timothy 1, verse 7. You can face things in confidence when you know that you're safe, can't you? The reason why we had those homiletic and speech classes at Ambassador College was so that we could be in a situation where we felt safe. We weren't talking to 300 people. We were talking to 8 or 10 or whatever it was of our peers, and we knew they weren't any better than us, so it was a safe area. God does that with us as well, in stages. Fear should not hold us back from good things to enjoy in life. This fear of God is not about immobilizing us. It's about teaching us and showing us what is acceptable and protecting us from bad consequences. You know, the expression of the best way to not get involved in these situations or overcome them is to not get involved in them to begin with. The best way to not become an alcoholic is to not drink to excess. The best way to not become a drug addict is not to get involved in drugs. The best way to not get in trouble is to not go into situations that are going to get you in trouble. I mean, think about what God is teaching us on this holy day and every other holy day and every other Sabbath day and every other time we gather before him. He's teaching us what works. We don't have to get hurt all the time. And oftentimes, the best lessons to learn are the ones that others learn for you. Once we have a proper fear, proper respect and trust and awe in our Creator, then we can know how to be safe in an increasingly unsafe world. And we can see evidence that should show us that he is a being that means what he says and that he should be obeyed. Let's begin to conclude here in Isaiah 41. God is clearly a God to be feared. But as I've said a number of times, that fear should not lead us to being incapacitated. I know people who will not travel because they cannot get themselves on an airplane. I know people who will not go outdoors because of the things they fear out there, or people that limit themselves in serving God's people because they can't stand up here and speak or song lead or give a prayer or sing or whatever it is. That fear incapacitates us and it limits us. That's not the fear God is talking about. Look at the freedom that we have in the law. I never have to worry about a sexually transmitted disease if I never have an affair, do I? It's not even on the radar. It gives me so much freedom to not worry about. I don't have to worry about my life. As terrible as things can be, some years back I gave a series of Bible studies before the Feast of Trumpets on many of those prophetic events leading up to that time. And my son and daughter were much younger. They were probably about 10 or 12 or so. And very unsettling for a child of that age to hear these things. And my son finally said at one point that he was scared of those things. And I said, well, think about it. You know what'll happen. We covered all of that stuff. What would happen if you would die during that time? Because that was his fear. What if I don't live? And he had been listening, and so he said, well, I would be in the kingdom. And I said, there you go. As horrible as that final event physically might be, he has a hope that most of the world doesn't have. That's Matthew 10, isn't it? We might die in this lifetime. We might die under bad circumstances. But that's not what we fear, not what we should fear. Isaiah 41 and in verse 13. For I, the eternal your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. I hope that most of you, if not all of you, have had the experience of being a child and being unsettled and having your parent simply take your hand and saying it'll be okay. This is the God that we serve. God is not asking the impossible of us. In fact, he's provided every means for our success. He sent his son to die for us. He put all of this into place so that you and I could have the possibility of being in his family. And if we're fearful, then we'll draw back. We have opportunities to serve this week. We have opportunities to meet new people. And perhaps to listen to their stories that they've not been able to tell others, or simply to have a receptive ear because they're in an area where there aren't a lot of other God's people. We have opportunity to enjoy a fabulous part of God's creation, perhaps in a way that we don't have back where we are. God gives us so much in understanding his plan of salvation. What would you give that you have now in order to live forever? If we have nothing to give, do we? Because again, it all came from God to begin with. All we can do, as was mentioned, again, is our effort, and through that effort, our obedience. God says here in Isaiah 41:13, don't fear. I'm here to help you. And he says to us, this is what I'm going to do. And he lays out this plan of salvation that you and I rehearse each year through God's holy days to understand that it's not just even us. It's all of mankind. Somebody has to start the process, and he decided it was us. Are we going to be up to the responsibility? Are we going to make the most of these days that we have, this coming week especially? This Feast of Tabernacles that we'll be observing for the next 7 days are an expression of our obedience to God, that we say to him, yes, I fear you, but in loving you, I will obey you because I want what you have and what you want to give us. By fearing the consequences of trying to live a life of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, And rejecting that, we show God that we fear him. And in doing so, in rehearsing these days, and thinking about that, and trying to make that real in this coming week, you and I set the example. And we never know who's looking. Maybe God will use some of the interactions that we have with people that are not called right now, family or friends or coworkers back home, neighbors, that we will be the ones to work with them. Who knows? But you and I have opportunity in the next 7 days, especially, to learn to fear God and to love him. Will we do that? I encourage you to do so. Spend that time so that indeed we can do as God says here in Isaiah, that we can look to him and we can acknowledge him as a loving father, and that we will not fear what is to come, but rather embrace it.